Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Damon Rand, and today we're going to be presenting a talk on something we've been working on the past few years, which is developing a processing and analysis pipeline for monitoring deforestation via satellite. With me is Padraig Harley and Jill Bournazel, who will also be sharing the stage with me today. Absent is, unfortunately, is Ryan Elfman, who was originally scheduled to be one of the speakers today. He is in Kenya, so couldn't join us, but he did a lot of the technical implementation of the change detection itself. So if you do have any questions, we've set up an email address that you can email us, and we'll try and, if you have super technical questions, we'll try to, as best as we can, to answer them, but if not, we have an email address for you, and you can send them there. So we are Ecometrica. We're a software as a service company founded in climate science, and we're passionate about clear, correct, meaningful sustainability management tools to help businesses meet their sustainability challenges. To that end, we have two main products. One's a sustainability reporting platform that is basically a greenhouse gas accounting platform. System, and we also have a mapping platform, which we're going to be talking about more today, and Jill will be giving a bit of a demo on, for combining client spatial information with Earth observation data. If you do have any questions for us, you can email us at phos4g@ecometrica.com, and we'll get you an answer to your question as soon as we can. So the project that this all came about out of was called Forest 2020. And it's a major investment by the UK Space Agency as part of an international partnership program to help protect and restore up to 300 million hectares of tropical forests by improving forest monitoring in six partner countries using advanced uses of satellite data. Those are the partner countries there: Mexico, Ghana, a few others, Brazil. And these are the partners, various companies involved, various academic institutions as well. And the challenge for us was to develop an end-to-end pipeline for processing radar imagery to detect forest loss. Essentially, given an area and a range of time, we want to automate the rest of the process. So we want a cloud-based service. We need to be able to fetch terabytes of data. We want to pre-process and clean the data, run the change detection algorithm on it, and diff the output against the forest baseline map. In this case, we used Hansen. Some of the open source tools and open data we're using: Ubuntu, Python, Docker, the ESA Snap tool, GDAL, Araster.io, Fiona, ND, which is the change detection library by Johannes Hansen at the University of Edinburgh, X-Array. We use Mapbox, GL.js, and React on our front-end interface, so you can visualize it. And we use Sentinel and the Hansen dataset. So the objectives was to scale the service out to be able to handle tens of thousands of areas, generalize across multiple forest types, ideally, and provide historical and near real-time analysis, and be an end-to-end service. Not all of these objectives have been met yet. We're still working on this for this project, as well as other clients as well. So where we're getting our data from is Sentinel. This is the Sentinel satellite, and we're working with the C-band synthetic aperture radar data. And you can see Sentinel works basically like this. There's two satellites that go around the Earth and create these swaths. And so imagine if you're looking at areas within these swaths at certain points in time. You know, you don't the satellites move, and so depending on when you're taking your time, the satellites are going to be in different positions. So you have to basically calculate all the different images you're going to need from the satellite. So if looking at my colleague Porik's homeland here in Ireland, if you wanted to get all the images for a one-year period from August to 2018 to 2019, you're looking at 4.5 gigs per zipped image, and it's going to take 2,065 images as an example. So the change detection itself, how do we do it? So we get the clean SAR VRTs, one for each date in the time series, and then we process those using the ND library. Basically what this does is it outputs a frequency of change per pixel. Then we clip that against a forest, non-forest map baseline to measure the change in forest, and we extract the pixels that have a change of a threshold of greater than 2. This was basically, that number was a result of a lot of trial and error and analysis after the fact. And the output is then a raster, which is then vectorized to a shapefile and prepped for visualization in our mapping platform. And now I'm going to turn it over to Porik, who's going to talk to you about the AWS pipeline that we built to go along with this.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. So can everybody hear me okay? Is it good? Yeah. Here's the schematic for how we actually get all of the setup going. You first get your area of interest. We serialize it to just a standard text wicket from our front end, and we send it back to the actual cloud, the change detection system from there. So you give it this particular date range that you're actually interested in, and then we do the search and filter against Copernicus or one of the DS providers to actually pull down those particular images that are required for that. We upload those zip files that we do get up onto S3, and then we use Snap to then do the pre-processing for the subsets of the areas from those images that we actually care about. So once we have all of that and we mosaic it into actual useful images for us, we then use our data cube with X-Array, which you've been hearing a lot about, I think, during the conference, and we use the forest baseline then to actually figure out what the metrics are and get the decision rules. And at that point, we also do some manual validation. If the thresholds are kind of in the middle area, we'll double check those ones. If we're happy with from the automated validation, then we're okay with it, and then we send the results back to the website. So the first thing is the actual Sentinel APIs. So I know there's a lot of ESA and Copernicus crew here, and some people from, I think, CryoDS are in the lobby as well. So Copernicus itself is fairly slow, mainly because it's handling it for everybody for free. So they actually have to keep it at a fairly solid level, make sure they're not giving everybody too much. There's limited 2 concurrent downloads per person, so we don't want to throttle it from that side of things as well. But it's free, it's stable, and the API is really, really good. And there's a lot of Python APIs and stuff, wrappers for it as well, which really helps. DS, like CryoDS, they're here. They're fast, they have multiple locations and providers, so it means you're not always knocking out Copernicus if you're actually trying to make these queries. The pricing's mixed. Some things are still available for free, others they have their own platforms as well, which cost money, but you can see which providers are actually giving what you need for it. They're in development. There's a lot of APIs. They're not all the same as Copernicus. I think, don't know if every one of them supports the OpenSearch API yet, but they also have a lot of stuff for their actual individual logins and everything as well, which makes it a bit difficult when you have to manage a whole load of different ones. So if anybody else is working on a library to access all of them at the same time, maybe talk to us afterwards, because we're also doing that, so we can pull resources. Also, the other one is the AWS Open Data Registry. That's on EU Central 1. Request or pay, so don't request more than you need, because it'll cost you more money. It'll only have Sentinel-1's GRDs and SL1Cs and L2As for the Sentinel-2. And it's the S3 API that you're going to have to use again there for that. The ESA Snap tool, for myself, it was pretty difficult figuring out Java, because I've always done a lot more Python work. So when something went wrong, it took a while to figure out what was going on. The documentation, for the same reason, is mixed, because it's a lot of Java API documentation, though I know they got a lot of tutorials online as well, but normally they're not in the areas that we've had curiosities in. Make sure that you have at least 8 gigs of RAM for whatever processing you're needing, because the Java JVM needs that much to just get going with the amount of data that we're pushing through it. But the support forum is good, and the devs are active, and I think Wednesday they had the talk about the Snap 7, which just came out in July as well. And the GUI is really good for generating those process graphs for terrain correction and subsetting and everything. And it's a really good tool to make sure that you know what you're getting first. Docker allows you to actually do that scoping of CPU and RAM. So you know you need at least 8 gigs of RAM or anything like that. You can provision it there. You can make sure it's not taking over the rest of your system if you're testing locally. It also means that when you're running in the cloud, you can actually set very fixed amounts of RAM and you can run. It's not going to eat up the entire thing, so that's good. It's scalable. The build is fixed and it's reproducible, which means that all the different devs and the analysts can all check it out and we can scale it out quite horizontally on the cloud, which has been very useful. Dependencies can cause the images to be really, really big. That's one of the things we're hoping to fix this year. And you might need more cleanup steps, and it's another tool for people to learn at the same time. So we use Elastic Container Service on AWS for managing this. There's two main options you have with that. There's Fargate and there's EC2 for self-managing it. So Fargate, you choose how much CPU you want, you choose how much RAM you want, you choose where in the world you want to do it, and it'll provision it themselves away from the rest of your things, and they just manage it for you. The problem you have there is that the container size is maxed out and fixed at the 10 gig limit, which is a Docker default limit as well. You can try and expand it with EBS and things, but configuring that with Fargate has been an issue, so we gave up on that part of it, but we still use it for actually doing the download management from Copernicus and Sentinel. And it's also a bit more expensive because they're managing more, so they charge you more. The EC2 part, it's self-managed, you have to choose basically everything, the EC2 instance types, you have to handle your own errors. You're using AWS's base AMIs for it, or either the Ubuntu ones or their own ones. So they handle the actual putting the Docker containers running on every single instance for you, so that's great. And then you choose what kind of storage you want actually on the machine as well. You can and you should use Spotfleet whenever you're doing this. Bid low and try and get as many as you can depending on what resources you need. There is also things like AWS Batch and there's more Lambda things coming, but Batch we couldn't debug easily. We needed to be able to be on the system to actually double check that everything was working as we expected, and sometimes you need to clean out some old dead containers before the auto one normally would. And Lambda, at the time, didn't have enough of a ability for us on that. So lessons learned on this, probably one that you already know, use S3 a lot, use it heavily if you're on AWS. Try and avoid using EBS and snapshots for storing all of your data. Make sure that S3 is your main storage location. You do a computation, you get your cached results from that. That either goes into ElastiCache or you're dumping the file computed back into S3 as soon as possible. S3 to AWS, as long as you're in the same region, the costs are basically nothing for the actual transfers. So make sure you're doing wherever your files are and you're computing in the same region to avoid that cost. Especially like if you're using the Open Data Registry stuff, that's EU Central. So make sure you're also doing your compute in EU Central to try and avoid some extra costs there. EBS is your on instance storage or the actual instance store itself. Use that during the runs, but make sure you're clearing everything out as well to avoid a lot of extra crap just lying around afterwards, temp files and things. You don't want to be paying more for it than you have to. EC2 Spotfleet, use it. Avoid on demand for this because unless you're, I need this task right now and I don't want to fiddle around with thinking about it. Even reserved instancing, if you buy a reserved instancing, you're paying for the entire time you've reserved, even if you're not using it. Most of the time, you're probably going to be using kind of big spikes of queries, so Spotfleet is really, really good for that. So plan your budget, set a max price that's still fairly sane. EC2 Fleet is a new system for choosing multiple different instance types as well, so you can choose many different families from EC2 at the same time to choose your RAM and memory across what's available. And configure your queues so that each instance should be downloading one image and checking all the areas for that one image, rather than downloading the same image to many, many containers, because that will just make all of your processing a lot slower. And that's me, Aunt Jill.
Thanks. Okay, so cool pipeline, but now we want to see a map. So what we're doing is that we display those change detection results on our mapping platform. So before I do a quick demo of the mapping platform, I just wanted to give you a really brief background on it. So it's intended as a platform for a wide range of environmental, social, economic data. It aims to simplify the extraction of information of increasing volumes of data that come from Earth observation or other sources. It provides a simple interface for non-user experts to get answers to a variety of questions. And basically, it makes spatial data accessible to the public, to stakeholders, and to non-GIS specialists. The data can be stored and backed up locally, but the platform runs on the cloud so that we can ensure it's always performing. It works with browser updates, and you don't need a local IT person to look after it. And we use agile development, so it's frequently updated with new features. This said, we're just going to move on to a little demo of the mapping platform. I've recorded it just to avoid live demo issues, but it's probably going to be epic anyway, so bear with me. All right, so when you just first log in onto the app, that's what you see. All the apps are designed around a specific theme to answer a specific question. And this one was designed to present the results of the SAR change detection that Porek and Damon just presented to you. It features results that were produced in window areas for three of our partner countries from Forest 2020, which were in Brazil, Mexico, and Kenya. And today, I'll only have time to present Mexico and Brazil results. So yeah, first thing you see is this introduction box. So that's fully customizable by the user, and it just gives a little bit of information on what this app is designed for and some kind of narrative info. Then we move on to this, the interface menus. First one is the layers. So layers are just visual maps of the data that was uploaded in the backend. That just gives a bit of context. And this first layer we're looking at here is the change detection output for an area called Rondônia in Brazil. So in orange here, what you see is forest loss that was detected by a change detection between February and September 2018 in this specific monitoring area. No, I knew that was going to happen. Gosh. Right. Okay. So we're back on track, kind of. So that's, yeah, the change detection. And then we just switching another layer, which is the forest baseline, which we extract from Hansen forest data, but it could come from, you know, other sources. And that just shows the forest that was available, that was not available, but present in your studio area before you start monitoring for forest change. And then the other kind of menu is the areas of interest. So for this demo, we're just focusing on this subsection of Rondônia, which is where we run the change detection. So each area on the application has a results section. And basically, when you click result, you just get a summary of what can the platform tell you about this queried polygon. So the results page display results that were extracted by the mapping platform from data layers uploaded in the backend. Basically, the mapping platform runs query calculations on datasets on this polygon that's queried here. And in this app, we've set up two queries. The first one returns the amount of forest loss detected by a change detection. So in this subsection, we found out that 555 hectares of forest were lost in this short amount of time for the monitoring period. So that corresponds to these orange bits we see on the map. And that corresponds also to 1.5% of this subsection that was deforested. And then the second query is just the results for the forest baseline. So you can see how much forest was in this area at the beginning. So it was about 34% of this polygon that was forest at the beginning of 2018. So that's kind of a first output for this type of like dense forest in Brazil. And then we're just going to look at the second type of forest, a different context in Mexico. So just moving a bit. So we're just going to look at the change detection in the context of avocado farming. So we can just select our Mexico areas here in the application menu and just, using the filter areas table, we just select the avocado area of interest. So that's where some of the avocado farms are located in the state of Jalisco in Mexico. So the first layer we're going to look at is the forest baseline, just to get a bit of context of what's happening in this area. Most of the forest is located on the west of the area of interest, and the rest of it, like kind of close from the forest, is mostly avocado fields. And then we're looking at the change detection output. So similarly to what we just saw, it's in orange means there was forest loss between February and September 2018. There was some loss in the north, but the majority of the loss was kind of detected in this area here in the southwest. And we can use the mapping platform to kind of explore the area a bit more. So when you look at the aerial photography in the base map, you see that the forest in this area is pretty fragmented, which is usually means like high risk of deforestation. And also all around it is avocado field. So there's quite a high assumption here that the forest is slowly being cut off to make more space for new avocado fields. And just one more tool I wanted to show you on the platform today, which is quite useful in this kind of exploratory work, is that users can hand-draw their own polygon of interest. So let's say you're a producer in this area and you just want to look at the state of the forest near your fields. You just hand-draw this polygon. You can just give it a name, save it. And then similarly to application polygons, you get a results button. And when you click on it, the platform runs the queries on the fly, and you just get a summary statistics of how much forest was lost as per change detection in your area of interest, and how much forest was also present at the beginning of the monitoring period. Right, so that's the URL of the app we just presented to you. So feel free to just go and explore it a bit more by yourself. You can send us any questions if you have any. That was just a short overview of what the mapping platform can do. There's many more functionalities in this tool, but I hope that gave a better idea of what the change detection results look like and how they can be used to make informed decisions on supply chain impacts on the environment. Thank you very much. And yeah, we have time for some questions, I think. Thank you.
So, I'm very interesting. I'm very interested. I have many questions, but I'll leave it to the floor. Yes, please speak up so people can hear it.
You shouldn't keep the question.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, just keep the one.
Okay. Sorry. Sorry.
How did you build the forest mask? You got it from neural network, so it's a cadastral mask. And how you compare it to satellite images?
So the forest mask we use in this project is from Hanson data, so that's already available, you know, forest data that's free to download, and it's a global forest data. So we just download the data and just process it to have a forest baseline that's up to 2018 or whenever is the beginning of our monitoring period. So we don't do any of this processing ourselves. We just use freely available data for the forest mask. But you could use any forest mask you have. If you have your own forest mask that you know is more accurate than the Hanson data, then you could just feed it into the change detection.
To answer your other question, for the change detection itself, for the actual metrics, that's mostly been Ryan who did the actual analytics back and forth and testing out a whole different variety of them. But I know he used a lot of, there was random forest being used and a lot in the ND library that Johannes Hansen, different Hansen, made. So he's doing that in Edinburgh and he's collaborating back and forth with Ryan on that. So that's an active development. So that tool allows you to actually choose from a wide range of things that you can test on.
Yeah, if you have a very specific technical question, please email it to us and we'll get it to Ryan and he can answer it directly for you. Sorry.
So deforestation in Brazil is obviously a hot topic these days. I've done a little work in Brazil and the thing that surprised me the most is how bad the cadastres are there. because they're self-reported and without topology and without verification and so forth. But they're the primary regulatory instrument that says, has somebody violated the law by deforesting more than a fixed percentage or specific areas. Mm-hmm. Have you guys given thought as to what tools might be made available to kind of help on that aspect?
We have done some stuff in the past.
Well, I guess what we're doing here could maybe be seen as a different type of accuracy because we're taking into account different type of forest and terrain and things like that, and we spend quite a lot of time validating the results. But if you have the, like, you know, the national kind of monitoring agency that is producing results and those results are like used in policy, then you can't really overcome that. So I think
it's depends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's like you can just. Yeah, how do you fit in into? So the work we do with Forest 2020, actually, we work with INPE, which is the agency that produces PRODES, which is the national data used in Brazil. And so, yeah, we're trying to just collaborate a bit more and see if like we can help with improving the methodologies to detect forest change. So yeah, that's all we do, and hopefully that's going to be enough in the end. But we'll see.
Question, Martin.
Oh yeah.
This question is not particular to your project here, but I think your company has a lot of experience working in these environmental monitoring projects. So my question is, when you do these computations, and you run them in the cloud and you spawn all these processes, how much forest loss did you occur through your computations? I mean, you know, equivalent. Is that, and you know, it's kind of a devil's advocate question. Is that factored into like tenders these days? Like when somebody's tendering, you're allowed maximally to emit, you know, these.
We as a company, we do our own environmental greenhouse gas assessment using our own product. We dog food our products ourselves. So we do a full greenhouse gas accounting assessment of our own company every year. And we do offset all our emissions, including our travel to this conference.
And do a brute force computation to show monitoring of something that actually you now cause more damage than you reported in, you know.
We do as part of the sustainability. We actually, because we report and we calculate on our estimations on how much actual computationally cost wise we are as part of our reports. If we are being asked for that, we can actually provide it to any any.
It's not, okay. I get your question. I don't think it is. I can double check with our project manager who's looking at Forest 2020, and she's the one who worked on the tender and the proposal. I haven't heard of anything like that, so I don't think it's in the tender.
Can I ask a quick follow-up that's related, which is just like, since you've done the calculations, like how much is field work flying to Brazil versus
just
EC2 instances? You know, mm-hmm. How much is like your overall compute versus overall travel?
I would imagine the travel is typically our biggest emitter.
Yeah. Something.
Definitely. You ever considered using it in Europe?
Using
flying tomorrow on the European forests.
We will use it wherever people want us to use it, basically.
Yes.
We're not geographically bound.
No.
We're using it for a variety of companies right now as well in different regions, in Ghana and Argentina, and as well.
Yeah, we do a lot on tropical forest right now. We don't have many projects in Europe, but this is like a universal methodology, so you could apply it to any type of forest.
Okay. So one last question, quick.
Just to show back the URL of the project.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I think we'll have plenty of time in the coffee break because there's a lot of questions here also. Because we had a windbreak, we had a damage from forest as well, and it would be nice to check this. Thank you, everybody.